here. I did want to, you know, one kind of a, you stole my thunder on that. I really want to dive into the zoning and the implementation, but you're not going to let me do that. But I would say one of the big picture things in reading the plan is along these primary transit networks, I have a little bit of a concern that we don't have enough nodes, potentially. And I imagine there's a lot of analysis that went into that, but that's, it seems to me that some of the opportunities for redevelopment might be a little bit less than what could be based on the number of nodes, and of course how that plays into transit and land use.
Can we try to address that when we get to that page on the page?
Is that high enough? There, did I get in trouble this time?
No.
Okay.
Okay. So, we have a technical gap, maybe? Well, we can, so the material's here, and we can just start going through the packet material. So if you look first at page 3, just really what were some of the major themes and things that we're trying to prepare for as we laid the groundwork for mapping out our future. We understand that we have an anticipated roughly 50,000 new employees, 50,000 new residents, and roughly 23,000 housing units that we have to accommodate for as the community continues to grow. Now the plan horizon is up to the year 2040. If we don't grow as fast as anticipated, we might be up to 2045 in terms of the length of time that the plan is really valid and helpful for us to be mindful about how we strategize some of the development opportunities that we have. If we move to page 4, what's being highlighted here in chart is a reflection of some of the sense of community engagement that was done. You might remember early on in this process, we started with some early community engagement, laying forth some of the projections around community growth and needs that need to be considered in the planning process. When we did that, we also put forth some conversation toolkits. So we had an online interactive crowd gauge tool that was used. And we also had a number of live events in which we had a significant number of community leaders who participated in those live events to help identify some of the priorities that would help frame up the needs of the community and priorities for the community as we develop the plan. I'm kind of looking at Charlie to see. When we get to the next one, we're going to start talking more about the core principles. But the other thing that we did is we partnered with Southeast Minnesota Association of Realtors, who got a grant from the National Association of Realtors to do a statistically significant phone-based survey of the community. And that phone-based survey helped to really define whether or not the pulse of this community was matching what we saw as national trends in terms of home ownership and neighborhood quality and characteristics that they would prefer. And what we found is a confirmation that this market is not providing the expanse of different housing and lifestyle choices that the community would like to see. They would like to see more diversity in housing types and styles and in opportunities to have more goods, services, entertainment, work close by within walking, biking distance. So that helped to frame up the need to be looking at how do we entertain those strategies that might help us diversify the housing and lifestyle choices that people would like to see here. It doesn't mean that the kinds of choices we have available today go away or that they're irrelevant. It just means that we need to be more diverse in what we're offering.
Lindsay, just yes. a quick comment. I don't see it here, but I think it was in the materials in our packet. You made a comment about continuing to emphasize the downtown core as kind of an economic hub. And as I listened to you talk, and I was thinking about amenities and transportation and neighborhoods, and I wonder, as a city, as we continue to grow, certainly we'll have the core downtown, the healthcare facilities, but I think we'll have some opportunities to emphasize pieces and portions of the city. If I think of certain areas of the city, you might conduct most of your daily activities within that segment of the city, whether it be grocery shopping or going to the bank or things like that. You don't necessarily need to come downtown or to other quadrants of the city. So I think as much as we try to look at a comprehensive plan for the entire city, I think there'll be some opportunities to look at smaller segments of our city and ensuring that we have all of the options necessary for the people that pretty much live and work in that area.
As we dive into this, I hope you'll see that actually does come through.
Okay. I just wanted to pile on in support of that and say that, you know, there's certainly that's what I envision these nodes to potentially be, but also, you know, part of the push to try and get that small area planner within the planning staff is specifically aimed at doing exactly that, figuring out where we have opportunities, how do we exploit them, not just downtown.
Okay.
One of the other rather significant things that changes in our future that we haven't had to deal with in our past is the largest growth in our households is actually in single-person households. That's not reflected on the maps and things that you see here, but in many of the presentation materials that we shared with the community, we identified what's different about our future that we have to think about, we have to be responsive to. And so we do have an aging population. We have to think about that as we continue to grow. We have a growth in single-person households, which is the largest share of our household growth. And we also have an intensification of our downtown that isn't the core focus of this plan, but the plan has to be reflective of that intensification and has to be responsive to it in a way that allows us to have a livable community that gets more and more employees to and from the employment center without getting as many more single occupancy vehicles to and from the employment center. So strategies were included in here to identify how we can do that in a more cost-effective and efficient manner. Charlie, we're going to start walking through the core principles, and I don't know if you want to start to dive into the conversation. We're in section 5 now, or I'm sorry, on page 5. So the guiding principles of the plan really came out of community engagement and technical assessment that identified some of what we had to do in order to make this giant puzzle work and to accommodate that future growth that we have, to be able to get more and more people in and out of downtown, to be able to do it the most cost-effective way that we possibly can. So integrating land use and transportation is a very key strategy within this plan and helps us to make sure that the kinds of land uses that are being laid out in different locations capitalize on and benefit from where we might do transit investment or other kinds of transportation investments and vice versa, okay? And that they don't actually compromise the other so much, but they're working in harmony. Expand housing diversity. Much of that came out of looking at national trends and data and getting a statistically significant survey feedback from this community and talking to folks who work in this market. Enhance the integrity of existing neighborhoods. I think as we continue to grow as a community and those locations that are closer in toward downtown are more and more desirable as places to redevelop, as I look right out the window at one of our newer redevelopment projects. We have to be mindful about the fabric of these older neighborhoods as well. The other thing that we have to be mindful of is that we don't ignore the need to reinvest in some of those neighborhoods with things like the CDBG home rehab program, which helps to bring quality back into neighborhoods and into older and aging homes, especially where there may be more concentrations of lower income households. Improve community connectivity. This is really kind of a broad subject area, but having viable transportation options for people. Again, we heard pretty clearly that the community does want more options that are viable. We've always valued community connectivity with our street networks, our sidewalk networks, and our trails, and our mid-block connections and so forth. This is really reflective of that as well. But we also added in that we really need to be looking at managing peak traffic by providing a range of commuter services. So again, we have limited space within our roadway network to get more and more vehicles in and out of our downtown, but we must find a way to be able to get more people in and out of downtown over the next 25, 35 years so that we can capitalize on the opportunity we have for having a more dense and compact and economically vibrant downtown. But in doing so, we also thought, as we heard from different input, that creating public spaces that are inviting, functional, and comfortable is also an important factor, because having a livable community that is attracting and retaining talent, visitors, and others is really an important piece to our economic vitality as a community long term. Emphasizing fiscal sustainability was something that came out from a number of conversations. We've heard that as a value from the council, at least from some of the members of the council. But we've also tried to recognize the city has limited resources, and there are more needs than there are resources available. So as we look to our future, how can we grow in a way that helps us be more fiscally prudent and sustainable with the limited resources that we anticipate in the community? The other piece that kind of helped to solidify that, hopefully some of you will remember seeing this document, and I apologize because I don't have enough of them for people not at the table. So if you could pass these down. This was the result of doing a scenario planning process in which we looked at a future that evaluated a trajectory of past trends, looking at the kinds of densities and development patterns that replicated the previous 20-30-plus years. When we look at alternatives moving forward that would include two different levels of a more compact future, and there needed to be a way to evaluate pros and cons of these different options. So consultants had put together a matrix of measures. Actually took each of those separate potential futures and evaluated things like how do we measure out in terms of vehicle miles traveled, congestion, lane miles of heavily congested road versus severely congested road, what's the access to high-frequency transit. That is a key piece to being able to get more and more people into our downtown, and again, to support that economic center. And downtown access mode share, how does that pan out? And what are some of the costs associated with these different scenarios that we evaluated? So again, this was a very informative piece to identifying some of the strategies we really needed to pay attention to and include in the future. The other thing that we did with this, I'm just going to list out some of the other plans that were happening simultaneous with this and informing this, and this plan was informing others, because it also speaks back to this value of fiscal sustainability. The DMC development plan itself started right around the same time as the comp plan. Some of the comp plan kickoff work actually got delayed so that we could help circle around that plan and put energy into getting that developed further. The city's energy action plan, there was an all-hazard plan that was completed. Some of the community outreach that was done as part of that helped to inform the needs of the community and some of the priorities that went into this. The city's parks master plan was done during this time frame. We did some coordination with RPU and their RPU systems planning and wellhead protection. We also worked closely with the City Public Works Department on doing sanitary sewer assessment to look at where we have the best opportunities and the lower cost opportunities for sanitary sewer service, where do we have some constraints, and where are some of the higher cost areas that we may not need to be tapping into in this plan horizon as we're moving forward. Two other things, the integrated transit studies for the Destination Medical Center. Four separate studies that are really looking at technical solutions to transit circulator, parking strategies, and street use and operations. And a design effort on Broadway North as well. And the transit development plan for the city was also very tightly coordinated with this effort.
Yes. You talked about all these plans. Are they all integrated, or are they just listed as addendums to the plan?
They all inform each other. We did coordination with every single one of these. They informed this plan, and this plan and the direction of this and the community what we got as part of this informed those other things as well.
So I'm guessing my question is, you're using the word informed. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Does that mean these are requirements? Does it mean that they're just suggestions? What does that mean?
Most of these are already adopted.
Okay.
So if they're already adopted as direction from the city, they're informing what we need to be mindful of and align with in this plan. Okay, so the sanitary sewer study is informing this because it tells us where we have serious constraints, where there's significant costs versus where there are lower costs and more opportunities for gravity flow service that will help more easily serve over there. Okay? So that might not be a formally adopted plan, but it's a reality of what we have to work with as we look forward to our future.
And maybe for a better comfort level with the wording, this plan is consistent with what's in all those other plans. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think the intent here is to try to make them all consistently working together.
I think that's our intent. I hope that's
I think that's one of our ultimate goals.
Yeah, that's because we did put a lot of thought and effort and money into these other plans too. So,
Mr. Hickey?
And so just to pick up on what Mr. Bilderbach said, and I know you've heard it from me before, but I think we need to put something more up front in the plan that where there's a conflict, this is the plan that takes precedent. And also, as we collect these pieces and plans, we don't really have any formal review policy. So as these plans age out, are they still applicable? There's been a lot of work done on the Second Street now. So that Second Street corridor study is still an adopted plan. I mean, is everything in it still relevant, or do we have a five-year which is hard to do, but maybe the reason we don't keep plans around longer than we need to if they've been superseded. So I just think when there's a conflict, we need a hierarchy that says, and it needs to be up front, not buried somewhere in the depth of the plan.
We can move that toward the front. We actually did put language in there. I remember you bringing that to our attention one other time, but it might be hidden.
More than once, but yes.
So the next item is championing social equity and environmental justice. So the community in the past has adopted values to being an open and inviting, inclusive community. There have been efforts in the past to try to make sure that Rochester is welcoming to people of all different backgrounds to come here. This is something we heard during community engagement, but is also trying to pull forward some of the things that have been adopted and endorsed by the community in the past. Maybe it's been past councils, but those are values that have been laid out for the community. When we talk about environmental justice, that really has less to do about the environment itself and much more to do with being just and not toward persons who are more disadvantaged, and not disproportionately putting burdens on them with public infrastructure investments that then would be put on other persons who are not disadvantaged. So I'll just give you one example of that. Yep.
Mr. Hickey.
So, I mean, I think most of our plans now are ADA compliant. Are there areas where we go beyond ADA? I mean,
we actually, through our role with ROCOG as a metropolitan planning organization, we have an environmental justice protocol that we have to follow as well. And that, so an example of that would be, let's just say you're putting in a new major roadway and there's nothing, there's a two-lane road and you're going to make it a six-lane road. All of a sudden the volumes are going to go sky high and it changes the character of that area significantly, right? But in doing so, you're taking very, very low-income, impoverished communities adjacent to that place, and you're burdening them with that impact. And areas with medium and high incomes don't have to bear that burden. That's just one example. I don't know, Charlie, if you want to add to that one, because you work a little more closely in that.
Mr. Rojic also has a question.
I think the other thing with environmental justice is to recognize that focus in part on past investment and what has been done in the past that has benefited or kind of these disadvantaged populations or where choices have been made to put those populations.
So what do we, I mean, we're using code word. What's disadvantaged population? What are we talking about? Poor people or old people? What are we talking about?
Low income, minority, disabled are the three primary groups.
And we're going to come up with a land use plan to do, I mean,
this is a combination of land use and transportation plan. I mean, the discussion here initially is on land use, but when you look at the plan, there is a transportation section as well. So these eight principles are speaking to both land use and transportation.
So won't we serve geographies instead of individual people? I mean, how do you...
Those people are located in a physical area. So, you know, the issue is if you have a neighborhood that's primarily low income, let's say, and you're looking at the investments in the past in terms of street maintenance or the lack of sidewalks, is there a pattern related to those kinds of neighborhoods that suggests that they have been bypassed for improvements?
And have you seen this in Rochester in the past?
What we're saying is in terms of policy, is that we need to keep that in mind as we go forward.
And if I just said,
you can look at, I mean, I'll pick out a neighborhood on Marion Rose in the area of Park, 24th Avenue, Mobile Home Park, you know, that area lacks sidewalks. That area, you know, the transit service is on Marion.
So when we redid the street there, our policy is to add pedestrian facilities as we redo the streets. So when we redid the streets in that area, we specifically neglected that neighborhood? Is that what you're saying, or what?
Well, I'm just saying that as
so we already have a policy. I think we're come up with a solution for, you know, and looking for a problem. So our current policies in place would cover that. Pedestrian facilities go in when the road gets reconstructed. So if it was a former township road or whatever else, or preceded our pedestrian facilities. So I guess I don't understand. I do believe we're coming up with a solution and then looking for the problem.
Mr. Woody.
Well, I will be so bold as to say that social equity and environmental justice are in fact issues here in Rochester.
So let's just talk about a specific example. So we talked about this Marion Road neighborhood. So we reconstructed a street there and we didn't follow our policy to put in pedestrian facilities. Did that actually happen or is that just a hypothetical?
In the city of Rochester, what you want to look at for park access is a 10-minute walk, depending on where you're at. Marion Road is underserved in a lot of ways, transit being one of them. But here's the thing is, we can debate this all we want, but I just wanted to, when this came up, I wanted to remind everybody what the official policy of this body of the city of Rochester is. And it was adopted on it was signed on the 21st day of August 2012 by President Staver and Ardell Brady. It's a resolution that's been prominently under the council section of our website, and it specifically comments to the our commitment to equity issues and to environmental justice issues, and that is the official policy of the city council. And of course that policy can be changed anytime we want, but we have to remember that those of us that sit at this table are much whiter, much wealthier, much older, and much more male than the rest of the community. And while you might not believe that there's social equity problems in the community or environmental justice problems, I assure you there's a big segment.
So the example
of the community
that was given
does.
Was a specific street in Marion Road, and it's a hypothetical. It didn't really happen. We already have policies in place to cover it.
If you have a policy in place and the people who don't get the services they need for 30 years, that's still a problem. And keep in mind that having it in the plan does no harm. What is the harm of having social justice policies in your comprehensive plan?
Because I don't think it belongs in the comprehensive plan.
Well, you know, there's comprehensive plans all around the country. The Urban Land Institute is involved in a number of these types of studies. This is fairly consistent by professional standards that I've seen. If you're seeing planning somewhere, you know, through your resources or research that says this isn't important, you know, you can share that with us. But I stand by that these should be priorities for the city of Rochester. And of course, we can modify the policy anytime there's a motion and a second to do so.
So again, whether it's the overall goal as opposed to a land use function, okay? Mm-hmm. So sure, we want, you know, equity in the community. But we already have plans in place that address this specific issue. So the example given was reconstruction of roads and pedestrian facilities. We don't have a problem with that.
Ms. Baker?
So this is looking at how we grow and change in the future and where there are opportunities for making investments. These principles can help guide decisions and help to justify looking for alternative ways to do things or to mitigate for the negative impacts. Whether the council wants to debate if this is a viable core principle, I think it's something that we'll have to vote on as a whole body. I think we'll make note that this is something you probably want to have a discussion about at a future time in terms of voting and whether it stays in here as a core principle or not.
Right, fair enough. Thank you.
Mr. Rusko.
Let's see, isn't this kind of based off what Rokog hired Phil Wheeler to do? We did that report and finding. I know, Charlie, I think you were there too.
It's not based solely on that, though.
But that report kind of gave facts and figures on that tied into this, correct?
Correct. Actually, been through two cycles. So what Phil did was an update to an environmental justice policy that was probably adopted a decade ago.
Okay.
And that report actually, you know, the conclusion was that we're actually, as communities go, doing a pretty good job on these issues relative to a lot of places. We don't have as much concentration of poverty or races as other places, and that's a good thing. We should keep doing that.
Right, and that was something the council in the past, past councils have made a concentrated effort on, is to make sure that housing is spread throughout.
So the last one here is maintain a commitment to health, wellness, and the environment, and supporting livability through a vision of health in all planning, facilitating active living, continue to invest in parks and recreation, consider safety and security in design and preparedness planning, and plan green infrastructure to support environmental health. So there have been past initiatives and efforts by the city, and some of these values have been solidified. Community values. These are things that we've heard from the community that they would like us to be mindful of and integrate as we go forward. I don't know if this is one that you may also want to have a discussion on and a formal vote on at a separate time. With these things, what these items do is really help to solidify the values of parks and recreation, to providing opportunities for people to live healthy and active lives. There was an active living and active community planning initiative that took place here in the community. It was about 7 years of dedicated time specifically on that topic area and worked with community partners to identify policy changes to enhance our community and its livability, and there were a number of changes made, and we see some of those changes incrementally continuing to improve the community. I'm going to turn it over to Charlie now. I'll put the computer away. Thank goodness we had paper.
So I talked a little bit about the development vision. So one of our intents in terms of providing a high-level overview of what the framework for the transportation and land use is being recommended in terms of the plan, we thought it would be important to include this piece in the plan as kind of an introductory piece, so that development vision is intended to show in kind of broad strokes how we see the future land use and transportation corridors evolving over time. So as you can see, there's four key elements that help to define the future footprint of the community, those being neighborhoods. Then the second category is what we call centers. Now this includes both what I would call transit-oriented centers, but then there's also another set of centers that really are located in places where the level of transit service won't be as great. They tend to be more auto-oriented, so we try to distinguish those kinds of areas, but the centers are really the highest kind of intensity activity that we find in the community, obviously including downtown, but moving out from downtown and including areas like the various shopping centers, educational campuses, and those kinds of locations. Similar to that with the corridors, the vision also describes what we see as corridors where there will be a heavier emphasis on transit, and as we've talked about in the past with you, and as discussed in quite detail with the plan, we have this idea of primary transit network, so we have what we call transit supportive corridors highlighted in the blue shading. And then, even though we don't show them on the map, there are other categories of corridors, things that are more highway, vehicular oriented, that either regional highways or urban highways, and then also what we call regional streets or urban streets that are intended to be more multimodal in nature. And then the area of districts are really intended to identify those areas of the community aside from neighborhoods, aside from kind of the residential areas where we have larger expanses of other kinds of land uses in a contiguous area, so to try and highlight where those are and are anticipated to be. So again, as I said, this is just kind of intended to provide, if somebody wants a high-level overview of where we see the community evolving, the development vision is intended to provide that. And then the subsequent mapping that we'll talk about here really then tries to provide more detail and sort of break down this high-level view of the future community. So with that, any questions? So we move to the next section, which Nixie has actually talked about a little bit already, and with the kind of overview she gave of the scenario analysis process that was done early in the project. Again, the idea behind that was to help inform some of the decisions that were going to be made. There was a trend scenario where the assumptions were that the community continued to develop as it has in the past, basically a fairly low density, low intensity type of development for the most part, with a lot of the growth on the edge of the community. If you refer to page 8 and look at the graphic in the lower left, those areas that are kind of highlighted in gold show under the trend scenario where the kind of majority of future growth was anticipated in that particular scenario. And then there were actually two alternative scenarios that were analyzed, which placed more of the focus in terms of growth on a set of what we ended up calling transit-oriented corridors and transit-oriented centers, pretty much focused along the Broadway access north and south, and the 2nd Street and 4th Street South access, east and west. Also looking in the future of extending kind of these primary transit corridors into the northwest area of the community, picking up the IBM kind of development area as a node as well. So if we turn to page 9, some of the high-level results of that scenario analysis was that in terms of land consumption and what would be expected to be lands that would be developed in the future under the trend scenario, the assessment came up with about 5,900 acres of currently undeveloped land would be needed to meet the growth needs following historic trends. And if we move to a pattern where growth is more compact and we see more emphasis placed on the set of transit-oriented corridors with good transit service, with the idea that that would attract more development into those areas where it could be served with more frequent transit service. We would see that the amount of land that would be needed for future development would be lower. You could see about a 15% or so decline in terms of the number of acres. See vehicle miles of travel go down. The miles in terms of congested roadways in the future, we would anticipate to be about 25% less under that compact growth scenario, where there was more shift, particularly in the peak periods, relative to commuting, away from single occupant vehicles and towards more transit use. You see that with a compact scenario and under the assumptions about development intensity, that a higher percentage of people would be within, residents would be within walking distance of that transit service, so it would make that a more attractive option for people. Certainly it comes, you know, a key piece as you look at that kind of a development pattern is what it means fiscally, and particularly with this idea of the idea of mode shift as it relates to commuting. And we see that the operating costs for operating the transit system would be significantly lower if in fact we were able to move towards a land use pattern that supported higher frequency transit and greater use of transit. The downside or the offset of that to some degree is that the capital cost for putting in place that higher frequency transit system is going to be slightly larger than if we continue to operate the kind of transit system that we have in place today. But you see that the capital cost difference on an annual basis about $3 million, where the operating cost savings would be about $10 million. So there is a offset that appears, you know, to lend itself to the idea that the compact development scenario would be more fiscally sustainable over time.
Could you explain to me how the capital costs are higher? Is that because of higher land values, or what's the...
Well, the thing that's happening with, you know, with the idea of primary transit network is the idea of moving towards a bus rapid transit mm-hmm. system. So there is infrastructure that comes with that that you don't have with the bus service that we have today.
Oh,
so
okay.
The stations...
So this isn't an apple. This is a high. This is a better transit service versus the existing transit service. It's
correct.
Not. So the actual cost is because we're moving to a more advanced form of transit.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. So okay. If you think of, I guess for people, one of the easier ways for people to think of bus rapid transit is a system that has the features of a light rail system,
mm-hmm.
but it's not on rails. It's your retired vehicles. So you have the off-board, you know, where you buy your ticket, not on the bus, so you're getting your ticket at the station platform. When the buses stop at a platform, people are just getting on, they're not paying for their fares. So it provides the benefit of you're able to obtain slightly better travel speeds and service times through these various features of a BRT system. So through those, again, all those things kind of play into people's perception of the system and whether they find transit a more attractive choice as a result of having that.
Mm-hmm.
And more, you know, typically it'll be a more reliable service as well because of the various features that are integrated into it, it's that type of a service.
And likewise, when you look at the annual operating costs, if you look at the more compact scenario, you're just serving more people with less distance of lines drawn up throughout the community. So if we're more sparse in our growth, we're going to have the buses go out further to pick up the number of riders versus a more compact pattern.
So I think the bullet points underneath really kind of highlight and talk to some of those relative trade-offs versus the trend versus compact scenario. I again, the idea, you know, one of the key things is what you mentioned before is the idea, particularly with downtown development. And one of our big issues there is we look at 26 to 30,000 more employees downtown. We really need to try and engage some kind of service or put some kind of service in place that will hopefully shift people that they drive to work and get them into another type of service, at least as it relates to when they're making that movement into the downtown area. So, you know, just for an aside, you're talking about the work that's being done in the transportation studies related to the DMC. You don't necessarily need to think about people getting on a bus where they live and taking it all the way in to work to a job downtown. That transit service that's being looked at as part of the DMC work will also include things like getting more people to drive to park and ride lots on the edge of town and getting an express bus to come into downtown. It will include more people driving to what are being thought out in terms of what I'll call peripheral lots around the edge of downtown, where they'll be able to use a circulator service from those parking facilities into downtown. So it's really about trying to intercept people before they reach kind of that core, if you want to think of it as kind of a corner around downtown, and really get into that core area where the traffic concerns are going to be the worst.
Is there any discussion on that?
So let's now, a few minutes ago, when I was talking about the development division, I sort of presented that as a high-level overview. I mentioned the fact that we have a series of maps here that really take that development vision and refine it. So there's a system of three, basically what I'll call a three-tiered map system. The first part of that is what we call the urban area growth map, and I'm on page 11 now of the handout. The idea and the intent of this map is basically to set some framework around the footprint of the city and where we expect the city to grow over the next 20 to 40 years. So as you look at the legend of this map and look at the colors on the map, what it's identifying for you is to start, obviously, the dark gray being the existing city limit urban service area where we have sewer, water services, kind of the whole range of urban municipal services in place to serve lands. Going beyond that, then we basically define three kinds of areas, what we call an urban expansion area, urban reserve area, and an urban influence area. So the areas in gold are the urban expansion areas. So over the next 15 to 20 years, those are the areas where we expect to see the growth that's on the edge of the city happening. And the reason for that is, in part, is that those areas have the those are the most easily served areas in terms of expansion of the sewer system and other municipal services.
Yeah, we'll pause there for just a second, because the other thing is that that area includes more land than we will need to accommodate the anticipated growth. So we're not confining the city in any way with that space that's designated. This is more land than is anticipated needed in the time period.
So then beyond the urban expansion area, in terms of long-term thinking, and thinking of 30, 50, 70 years into the future, we think it's important for the city to then identify sort of beyond that near-term growth, where are the likely areas for the city to expand beyond that. So when you start to look at the orange and kind of the reddish or pink colored areas, those represent those areas beyond kind of the near-term urban expansion where we would expect to see growth happen in the much longer term. And part of the purpose for identifying those is to sort of provide information to the surrounding jurisdictions so that they have an understanding from the city's perspective of where it would be kind of the most fiscally efficient provide services, and in doing so, help work, you know, with those townships in maybe setting up some guidelines in terms of what happens in those areas to foreclose, you know, kind of the development of those areas where we may see suburban subdivision or large lot, 5 to 10 acre lot type development that really starts to cut things up and makes it very difficult to ever extend sewer and water services in thin areas. So that's what the kind of the orange colored urban influence area indicates. And then the red areas are really to identify areas beyond that where we've already, where the city's already had discussions with the township. So the biggest long-term urban influence area that you see is on the west side of the city in Kalmar Township, where we already have what's called an early annexation agreement in place with the township, where the township and the city have agreed that there'll be a structure in terms of land use regulations that are in place for an extended period of years to ensure that we don't see sort of this incompatible suburban type development occurring in that area, so that in 30 years, 50 years, we still have the ability to extend the urban services into that area in a fiscally responsible manner. Slide 12. Just to sort of add an overlay to the urban growth boundary discussion. I think council is well aware of the studies that Public Works has been undertaking here in the last 2 to 3 years relative to the capacity and restrictions and constraints on the sewer, municipal sewer service. As a result of what we know from those studies today, what's been identified is the fact that about the southern two-thirds of the city, so basically all the areas with kind of the red patching, the red dotted pattern that you see on the map, are areas where the trunk lines that serve these different subsectors of the city have some physical constraints in those trunk lines that limit the amount of additional sewage that can be accepted into the trunk line from these various areas. So what the plan basically says is that as a policy going forward, that in those areas of the city, when new developments come forward, there will have to be an assessment completed to make a determination of whether the sewer generation of a proposed development will actually not be a problem given the existing capacity that's in the various trunk lines. So we expect over time that the city will be making investments to upgrade these trunk lines, which will then take certain of these areas, remove this limitation on these areas, and the areas would probably be redesignated as either an area, you see some areas here that are in gold and also some that are in green, the green being on the north side, northeast and northwest. So those are sewer sheds that do not have any restrictions in terms of capacity, so development can go forward in those areas without having to do an assessment of capacity constraints. In the gold areas, there are some limitations, but they aren't very great, but there will probably have to be sort of a simplified assessment done just to ensure that the pipes that will be serving, that would be serving a particular development do not cause any problems. So this is an issue, and it's something that, you know, in the past we have not had to deal with in a major way, but based on this work that Public Works did and the studies that they've had done, we have some pretty significant constraints that really affect, for example, the Little Creek area, probably the most constrained area being the west side of the city going out along Highway 14 west on both sides of Highway 14. So there will be some limitations probably in the near term as far as how much development can occur in those areas.
So just to tie pages 11 and 12 together, you can see the areas that are shown in green here on page 12 have informed, at least in the northern part of the city, where the yellow ended up, because that's the most easily served. And as you look on the southern part of the city on page 11, you'll see areas, most of those areas expected beyond 2050 for growth. So these two are going to inform each other in the sense that we have to understand these constraints and opportunities in the system. But we also know that as the community continues to grow, we need to come up with a strategy for funding some of the trunk main programs that are going to be needed, especially in the goal areas on page 12. Those are going to be your highest priorities in terms of your near-term sanitary trunk main upgrades. But then eventually we're going to have to address some of these other areas if the community is going to grow on the south end.
Question for Mitzi or Charlie. I know something that entered the discussion in recent months or years are more regional waste treatment facilities, regional solutions, and this seems to be predicated on our own capacity and what we have within the city. Do you factor in or consider those scenarios as, because that would certainly have some impact on this this map?
Right, so this is based on the current sewage treatment system that we have in place. If hypothetically there were some kind of a regional system in the future, I think there are two major pieces that come with that. One is the question of what land area does it serve, and is that land area needed for the city to grow? We actually can see that at least probably up to 2050, we may not need any kind of regional system to help serve additional growth in the city because there's plenty of land area already designated that's serviceable.
And
however,
go ahead.
That's why we need to continue to update this plan. 5 years, 10 years. We have to revisit that question because that idea might develop.
Because I think it, you know, it's not beyond the realm of possibility to have or consider a regional facility toward the northern boundary of the city that might serve not only our own development, possibly even communities to the north. And what that does then is it then potentially shifts so that we're not as constrained to the south part of the city. So anyway, I think you're right. We need to keep those things in mind as it starts to shift our shift how we address these things in our growth.
It's an excellent point because you may be able to avoid, in the next 50 years, you may not need to do some of these major trunk main upgrades if there's a regional system that allows for new growth to be coming in another geography.
Just to note, we're at the top of the hour. How are you doing on your time?
12 o'clock sharp.
No problem. We probably need to move a little faster through the rest of this.
All right.
So, moving to page 15, the stability of change map. The intent of this map is to introduce a layer that allows us to do some fine tuning in terms of the land use designations that we really didn't have the ability to do with our current land use plan. And I think the best way, and I think I described it to the council last spring when we were here, but one way to use an example of how to think about this is so we'll have a land use map, which we'll look at next, that will have like classifications of low density, residential, medium density, commercial, and so on. What we're trying to do with the stability and change map is provide some fine tuning, taking, for example, the low density designation as an example. If we're in a low density area out in one of these newly kind of these edge growth areas, as compared to a low density area where we have an existing neighborhood like Elton Hills or Northern Heights, versus a low density area like one of the neighborhoods like Slatterly Park adjacent kind of to the downtown area. What we expect to see happen in those three different low density areas is quite different. So what's happening out on the edge of the city is really a situation where with this plan we're trying to encourage more flexibility. Obviously it's going to be new growth, maybe a little broader, a little higher acceptance in terms of the density of development, in terms of dwelling units per acre, maybe acceptance of a little more non-residential development is kind of a approvable part of new development. So we want to provide more flexibility there. So that's an area that on this map is identified as an area of growth. We then turn to like a neighborhood like Elm Hills or Northern Heights, On this map, that's identified as an area of stability. So there we have neighborhoods that are pretty much fully built out. People have invested in their homes. You know, the public investment in terms of streets and stuff, maintenance is being done. We really don't expect to see a lot of change, and I think the expectation of the residents in those areas is not to see dramatically different development than what has occurred in the past. So we define that as an area of stability on this map. And then, for example, the downtown neighborhoods like the Slagley Park area or Eastside Pioneer area, where we are seeing some demand for change because of potentially disinvestment in private properties and really to make those properties, again, financially functional, feasible, the desire to do something that's maybe a little different than the original neighborhood development. So we identify those as part of the areas of change. So by making that distinction, when we get to the next step of crafting the zoning regulations, we can use these, this particular map to identify those differences between low-density areas so that we don't have just one set of low-density residential regulation, but we can have low-density regulations with reference to a growth area, to a stable area, and to a transition area like the downtown neighborhood. So we think it gives us flexibility in terms of building the zoning ordinance by including this layer in terms of the land use structure. The next slide, 14, was just kind of a follow-on where we just wanted to highlight the areas of change as compared to the areas of growth and areas of change contrasted to the areas of stability. So what you see on this map in the gray are the areas of growth that we've identified, and the blue and the red represent the areas of change. And the lighter gray, filling in most of the existing city limits, is considered, areas of stability. And the amount of change in those areas would be expected to be fairly minimal.
Quick question on this one. I think E14 tonight is the continuation of the consultant services for the zoning portion of this. And I just wanted to check, because I don't know if I necessarily saw a piece in there that would deal with the residential reinvestment area. How are we going to put the tools in place to cover that portion?
Some of that actually will be addressed by the consultant services. So if you look at the attachment to the contract there, it does outline some priority areas to be addressed. That includes an interim strategy for transit-oriented development. Mm-hmm. Tools for infill and redevelopment, and also some of the incentive and restricted development policies.
Okay.
Like that issue overlaps a number of those.
Okay.
All right. You want to get into the zoning discussion?
I'm doing my best, Mitzi. I'm really trying hard not to.
So the third and most detailed layer of kind of the land use framework and future land use plan. Again, this is really what we're all familiar with from our historic land use plan, where we get into having a fairly detailed list of different land use categories. The purpose of this plan is to guide really the application of zoning to properties throughout the city, provides a high-level overview. It also helps with planning for future infrastructure improvements that are needed by providing some guidance in terms of what the expectation is in terms of land use in areas that are currently undeveloped or where we anticipate to see redevelopment. I think the big thing with this map is that we have a number of new categories that we introduced on this map, particularly the mixed-use categories. And before I say too much about that, since we have some slides that specifically talk about that, why don't we just turn the page to slide 16 first. So one of the things that we've done with the land use categories themselves is try and provide more description and sort of more meat on the bone, so to speak, about each of the land use categories. So if you look at our existing land use plan report, for each of the categories, we really, the current plan really focuses on kind of locational factors. And we felt that, particularly with introducing kind of the introduction of sort of more emphasis on infill and redevelopment, that there was a need to get more into the idea of how do we deal with transition, what's the expectations in terms of maybe sort of general design principles as we look at, you know, areas between different land use categories. So what we've done with each of the categories is, as we show here for the medical campus category, is actually come up with seven different characteristics that we talk about for each category. So we go from sort of the general use type of uses that will be found in a given category, to the desired pattern of development, the range of density or development and non-residential intensity, the locational characteristics, which is kind of the one piece that's largely carried over from our current land use plan. We had some discussion about transportation requirements so that we get into talking about uses that may be appropriate for like local residential or local non-residential streets as opposed to uses that are better located on collector or arterial streets, those kinds of distinctions. And then some discussion of design considerations, which again comes into play more particularly in some of the mixed-use categories and sort of some of these redevelopment areas where we're, you know, going to see some contrast in styles and what, in terms of principles, should be the thought process and thinking about how to make decisions relative to introducing, like, maybe a slightly different housing style into an area like one of the downtown neighborhoods that's already fairly built up. So I thought maybe the important what I did here was kind of focus on, I thought maybe the areas that would be of most interest. So the first area I looked at is the land use categories. So we have a couple slides here on that. Slide 17 gives you a breakdown. Again, there's a lot of detail here. I wanted to sort of show the distinction from low density going up to high density and then some of the other areas where residential development's allowed. And sort of the differences in terms of the density levels. So you see the low density residential area has expected a very low level of intensity, 4 to 7 units per acre. Medium density would allow that level of intensity to go up to as high as 40 units per acre in appropriate locations. High density, which is going to be largely, but not solely, kind of in and around the downtown area, up as high as 120 units per acre. The traditional downtown residential, again, is the neighborhoods around the downtown. And then you also see at the bottom where each of the mixed-use categories, which I'll talk about in a second, also make provisions for residential development at varying levels of density as well. And then the another difference between the residential categories in terms of what other kinds of uses are allowed along with the residential use. So the low-density residential category, for example, allows some small-scale office, live-work, or neighborhood-oriented types of service uses. And as part of the low-density residential development, it's expected to be part of, you know, just the general neighborhood, general development in the neighborhood, although there were more than likely will be separate zoning regulations for those kinds of uses. But just to lay out in the kind of land use plan that kind of use is an accepted part of a low density area. And then just distinguish as we kind of walk up the ladder to medium density areas and high density areas, what kinds of comparable or complementary non-residential uses are allowed as well.
And just a note on low-density residential areas currently allow for some low-intensity commercial and office uses. So that's consistent with what we've been doing historically in that sense.
I'm not going to jump into zoning, but as this moves forward, do you see these more form-based tools then helping to support these abilities?
That is jumping into zoning. We will be vetting through those questions when we get the consultant on board and we start talking about best practice strategies and what might be best for this community.
Okay.
So be entertained.
So tomorrow.
Looking at page 18, I wasn't sure how much interest there would be, so I put this slide in here specifically about the downtown neighborhoods. So on the upper part, you see a graphic that highlights the areas when we refer to traditional neighborhood residential areas. There's kind of two levels as we see it. There's the areas highlighted in gold and the areas highlighted in green that make up the traditional neighborhoods. The differentiation of those is that in the gold areas, given their closer proximity to downtown and shorter walking distance, we feel it would be appropriate to allow for a little higher intensity of use because of maybe the less need that people would have to necessarily drive to work or drive to services or, restaurant locations or whatever that... These areas highlighted in gold are in very walkable distances of the downtown core. As you move out into the areas highlighted in green, that becomes less the case. So the discussion in the plan is that those areas, that the overall density would be slightly lower than what would be accepted in the gold area.
Are there any questions or comments on that concept?
What's the Pepto-Bismol color?
There's the pink. What is this one right here?
So the area where like Kmart store is located is actually an excuse transit point.
Well, I'm also looking between 7th Street and Civic Center Drive and.
And that's also a different category of mixed use transit.
Okay.
Slide 19 is just kind of an illustration, particularly relevant to that traditional neighborhood area of the kinds of higher intensity uses that might be expected to be seen in those areas, being proposed in those areas, we think. As we sort of span what's happening across the country, there seems to be a lot of interest in providing the ability to do these slightly higher density types of residential development that still are at a scale that are largely compatible with kind of the larger, older homes that are typical in those older neighborhoods. So again, you can see there to the left of the photos, the kinds of characteristics, and this actually kind of gets in your question, Mike, a little bit about the kinds of factors that the ordinance, that the Land Development Manual probably have to speak to ensure that we do in fact have development that's compatible in scale and character if we're going to permit this kind of housing to sort of occur in those areas. So yeah, think about the footprint, what we do with parking, design and design compatibility. It's particularly to the form and architectural character. Those kinds of things. So looking at slide 20, so this gets and highlights probably the area of the most significant change in terms of land use, where we're talking about areas that would be developed for mixed or would be designated for mixed use development. So we have a couple categories here. The dark red identifies the mixed use transit oriented centers. So those would be of the different mixed use categories, the one where the most intense level of future development would be permitted. The lighter red areas are then what we call mixed use transit supportive corridors. And then there's a third color of red, and I'll kind of direct you to 4th Street Southeast, where it's a lower density level with more emphasis on residential use as opposed to really a kind of allowing a greater share of non-residential use that we call a neighborhood or transport of neighborhood corridor. So again, this gets back to the idea of, again, thinking about how does land use integrate with the idea that we want to try and encourage more transit use in the future. So you see these areas that are designated along the corridors that will be highlighted as part of our future primary transit network. You know, where the idea of hopefully evolving to the point where we have enough intensity of use to support more frequent transit service and even bus rapid transit service would occur. So again, turning the page, a lot of detail here about mixed use, but really mixed use kind of takes a couple of shapes. You know, you can have either vertical mixed use as shown in the lower left, or horizontal mixed use as shown in the lower right. We would expect to see both of these kinds of development style occur. The vertical mixed use probably more likely in those transit nodes or transit centers, and the horizontal mixed use more likely to occur in some of the intervening areas along these transit corridors between the nodes. So we have different ranges of density suggested for each of the areas, as well as different levels of floor area intensity for non-residential uses. But in all three in the transit-oriented centers and the transit-oriented corridors, really kind of an open mix in terms of not really trying to preference residential to non-residential. What we're really trying to do, thinking about the transit service, is create a situation where we have a variety of destinations as well as living opportunities. So there's trip origins and destinations, both located in these areas. And then, like I say, some of the corridors, like 4th Street Southeast, where we designate that as a transit supportive neighborhood, there the emphasis more tilts towards continuing a preference towards residential use, with less intense commercial use than in the other two.
I just wanted to do a little time check.
I'm making a list and a lot of people online.
All right. Carry on.
So looking at page 22 and 23, we just wanted to highlight a couple of what we felt were the important policy. I don't really want to refer to them as changes, but areas of emphasis in this plan as in contrast to the existing land use plan. So we have a fair amount of discussion in the plan about infill and redevelopment. And we felt that was important to include because of the fact with the introduction of the mixed use transit centers and corridors and a little more flexibility, that there's probably going to be more situations where we're going to see interest in doing infill and redevelopment in areas that are largely developed, but there's existing empty lots or there's buildings that sort of are beyond their, feasible use that need to be replaced and redeveloped. So quite a discussion in the plan about that. Just provided the definitions where we see infill and redevelopment being really the major types of activity that really result in new buildings. We also discuss a third area which may apply, for example, like in some of these traditional neighborhoods where the issue isn't so much replacing old buildings that are sort of at the end of their economic life, but really doing some things that more revitalize what's there. And that may involve some public investment. It may involve continuing programs where we assist people with upgrading their homes, those kinds of things, but it's more focused on revitalization rather than replacement. And the four types of infill and redevelopment, where we see that happening again is in these core neighborhoods along the transit-oriented nodes and corridors. We also talked a little bit about the concept of gray field redevelopment, which is, again, a term that's been sort of in the planning world for a long time, but that talks about the idea of redeveloping sort of shopping centers that have gone into decline. And to me, I think probably the two most obvious examples that we have that maybe are getting close to that point are the two Kmart sites on South Broadway and on 37th Street. And then the idea of adaptive reuse, where making use of reusing historic buildings for a purpose that's different from their original purpose.
So this is one of those questions for those of us not from Rochester. Where was the Kmart site on 37th Street?
Ivy.
Bowman.
Ivy.
Oh, okay. Bowman.
Next to
okay.
Ivy.
Okay.
Thank you.
You didn't know that?
I was scanning my mind.
Something I just want to add to this conversation is we talked about the primary transit network and the opportunities for revitalization along corridors that might be in decline in film redevelopment. It's no accident that this has been nicely aligned with the fact that Broadway is no longer a trunk highway. It's now a city street, and it is an opportunity for this community that we didn't previously have. It was built up as a state trunk highway. And some of the development that we see on there is just reminiscent of what was a trunk highway. But we really have a new opportunity ahead of us, and we're trying to reflect that here in this moment.
So I think everybody, just on page 24, is probably familiar with our commercial strips in the community. But one of the things with the crafting of infill and redevelopment policies is hopefully lead to a place where we start to see those commercial corridors that are a little bit aged start to get redeveloped or revitalized. So we've tried to craft a set of policies and include that in the plan that would help facilitate that to happen down the road. Turning to transit-oriented development, I don't know again how much we need to go over here, but you know what when we talk about transit-oriented development, it really is a combination of both land use features and transportation features. The land use side of it being, you know, encouraging the idea of mixed use, trying to increase the intensity of activity. Either in these nodal areas or in these corridors. At the same time that we're doing that, making improvements to the public infrastructure that attract or make the areas maybe a little more attractive in terms of walkability. Obviously, we're going to have changes that occur within the street itself in terms of things like transit investment, transit infrastructure to help the primary transit network evolve. The lower half of this slide just talks about some of the features, the idea of having pedestrian connections, street by pedestrian connections to adjacent neighborhoods that are comfortable and welcoming, particularly in terms of the centers, so places like 7th Street and North Broadway, 14th Street and North Broadway, really trying to kind of craft areas like that that have higher intensity use. Within an area that's about a 10-minute walk across. So if you're looking at maybe a quarter mile sort of radius of an area where high intensity use might be expected to be seen over time. In terms of the mixed use, really what the policies want to try and encourage is that we try and create more active street level use so that the retail you know, if there's retail frontage or civic uses on the ground level, that those ground level uses are open to the street, that we don't have kind of blank wall, so to speak, kind of development happening. Generally, the pattern of use on the corridors outside of the nodal areas, probably similar to what the Second Street Corridor Study talked about, maybe not quite six-story height, but something in the range of 2 to 4 stories being considered appropriate. And then the idea that the building height step down and you step back into the neighborhood.
Charlie, I'm going to suggest we jump forward to page 28.
I have a question on 25 before we get off. You talk here a lot about active street level, retail, arts, and so on, as you have here. Our city is pretty unique with our skyway level that we have a lot of already commercial built up, commercial access, and so on. Are you looking at saying that this would be a focus in the future at the expense of the skyway level? Or
outside keep in mind downtown. That this is outside of downtown.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. All right.
Good
I'll get to that one later.
so if we jump ahead a little bit to the transit network
That's
and
zoning.
The bus rapid transit vision, like part of what I heard here is some question about why there are not more nodes that were identified and how the land use and the PTN or primary transit were tied together. So those are maybe some things you want to touch upon, Charlie, think that would help.
Well, I think relative to the idea of nodes, when the analysis was being done, what was being looked at was the idea of both where do we see sort of concentration activity already occurring that could be intensified. So taking into account land use that were already there, looking at the footprint and the type of development. You know, what's particularly interesting is you look at areas like Northbrook or Northgate or something like that is where you have parking areas that potentially, as you get a shopping area like that into more of a mixed-use node, you actually have land that could be used and available to sort of restructure those areas. So I think that was part of the discussion that was had in terms of identifying, you know, where these nodes would be located. Another piece of it was actually thinking about how many nodes could a community of ours, or the size of our city support, and the analysis that the consultants had done sort of ended up sort of at the place where we're at, where we might have, you know, we have major nodes, about 5 of those showing the IBM area, 37th Street and North Broadway, 12th Street and South Broadway, and then on the east side, and then sort of a set of secondary nodes. Mm-hmm. But that's really was sort of the conclusion of the analysis, just thinking about the growth of the city, how much square footage that would generate in terms of non-residential use, how many more housing units would be needed, what would be a realistic number of housing units to sort of attract to these areas, that this was sort of where we ended up in terms of what was felt to be a reasonable number of nodes.
So part of that is in the next 25 years, there's a limited amount of what we anticipate is needed for commercial, for office, for retail, for residential low density, and residential high density. And once you look at distribution of those different land area needs across the community, you can't put them just everywhere and end up with the kind of impact you want. So if we want to develop a primary transit network, how much of that can reasonably be put in those locations while still accommodating for fringe-style growth that we've had in the past, right? A more balanced approach in the future instead of maybe all edge growth, but a combination of both. One other thing there is with the bus rapid transit system, if you can identify the primary locations for future stations, mm-hmm. potentially future stations, you understand that they're going to be spread out quite a ways. The bus rapid transit service does not stop block by block. That's mm-hmm. a local service. So the nodes are trying to coincide with those likely future stations.
That's actually quite helpful. What you're referring to as a node and what I'm referring to a node is a little bit different. I kind of see that high-frequency transit stop as being a node, but I don't think that necessarily there might be stops in addition to these. There's been a lot of publicity out of like City Labs and Urban Land Institute the last few weeks about transit stops being too close together in the United States.
what for Rochester, what is the optimal spacing for a high frequency transit? I mean, it's we can't do the 2-block thing like we're doing right now, but is it a half mile? Is it 2 miles? Is it?
I think we were kind of looking at a half mile,
okay.
Quarter to a half mile, okay. Being that range.
And then it'd be adjusted a little bit based on the low-hanging fruit that's already there.
Right.
Yeah. If we have two nodes that are maybe slightly less than a half mile apart, and they're really, they have high potential for development.
Okay. Yeah, half mile spacing equates to a 10-minute walk to transit for most people. So,
Kelly and Lindsay, how many commuters are expected to be using those park and ride lots? How many thousand?
From the DMC work, we're expecting to add somewhere between 2,500 and 2,500 spaces. So today we have about 1,500. So go to 4,000.
Okay.
Just real quickly, before 28, in the lower right-hand corner, there's a set of four little graphics there. Just want to emphasize, again, you know, we heard it previously, we made this point, but one of the nice things with the rubber tired system, like the transit is, unlike a rail-based system, where you have to spend a lot of money right up front once you make the decision, bus rapid transit can be phased in. Over time, with you can do some early investments in like station improvements and doing things like giving buses the necessary technology to like override, you know, the traffic symbols and do some things like that, and sort of build it up to the point where you actually got a full system in place eventually over a 10 or 15 year period. So, and that's really what's kind of envisioned in terms of how this TTM network would evolve, is that it would be investment not going to the full BRT right from the start, but building up to eventually, once we have sufficient intensity of land use along the corridors, to generate the type of ridership that a full BRT system would need. And, you know, we will already have made some investments that advantage the existing bus service, and then we can take that final step.
Mr. Ruska?
Keep in mind the half mile, let's just say, you know, for where we have the half mile stops, what kind of miles per hour are you talking on, you know, like at maximum time between half mile stops? Is it something that's really going to be a significant difference in what we have out there now? And if so, like, what kind of speed do you see these at?
We think with the various features that a BRT system has, that you could probably maintain service similar to the vehicle, the private vehicle of 25. I have kind of an average speed of 25 miles an hour. I mean, that's one of the problems with the current bus service, and kind of one of the features that works against it is by the time you factor in the stopping and getting in and out of traffic lanes, I mean, they're operating about 8 to 10 miles an hour. So the idea with BRT is to try where that gets where it's maintaining about the same speed as the traffic.
So less stops, but a higher than overall rate.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And more frequent, too. So if you take a look at page 28, it's the areas in red that we think are most likely to develop into the bus rapid transit service in the time horizon of this plan. The other areas are likely to develop beyond the time horizon of this plan. They may start to by 2040, but we think mostly after. And the hope there is we could possibly achieve service every 15 minutes at those major stations.
Page 29, again, just a paragraph here about what bus rapid transit kinds of features. The one thing I want to highlight on this page is the table on the lower half. From a planning perspective, to generate the kind of ridership that will really support kind of full-blown bus rapid transit, we really need to try and get to a level of density that along a corridor, like along the North Broadway corridor, where we have an average of about 25 people per acre. along that corridor. That can be a combination of residents as well as workers. So you have both your origin and destination kind of uses, but generally the level of development that gets up to about 25 people per acre. The reason I say that is right now our corridors really, except for 2nd Street Southwest, we are not at a level approaching anything close to 25 persons per acre. North Broadway is probably our next highest corridor, and we're at about 18, 19 persons per acre in that corridor. So one of the things we hopefully accomplish through the policies of the plan is attract a significant, a sufficient amount of development to get us up to those levels. And what that means in terms of PTN corridors, and that's why those two rows in this table are highlighted in yellow, is today along the PTN corridors, we have about 10,500 housing units. And we think that our target needs to be on the order of about 17,000 to 18,000 housing units along those various corridors, 2nd Street, North and South Broadway, 4th Street. And along with that, then adding about 800,000 square feet of various types of commercial service uses as well, is what it would take to get kind of those four primary corridors of North and South Broadway, 2nd Street, 4th Street, up to that level of development. So that may alarm some people. I mean, when we present this in the past, it has. The one thing I do want to point out, though, is if you kind of focus on the upper left quadrant of this chart and just look at housing for kind of the five different areas that we've looked at. So that's kind of the downtown and the DMC district, the downtown neighborhoods, the PTN corridors, kind of the rest of the built-up area of the city, and then the areas out on the edge, the urban expansion areas. We expect between today and 2040 that all those areas will see growth. So for example, downtown, we expect to see about 2,700 new housing units, about 1,000 new housing units in the neighborhoods around downtown. Like I said, about 7,000 new units along the PTN, and about 7,000 to 8,000 in the urban expansion area. So all these areas will see growth, but to really be successful with the PTN, we probably need to expect that there will be less growth on the edge and more growth along kind of the PTN network. And you can see in kind of the upper right quadrant of the table that for the PTN, whereas kind of continuation of historic trends, which suggests about 21% of housing units would be along the PTN network, we really need to get to where about 25% of housing units are along that network. And what that means in terms of the edge is that where the trends would suggest going from 17% to 27%, to be successful with PTN, that probably ends up more at about 22%. So just, again, as I said, that's been a question that's come up in the past, but just want to highlight that we'll see growth in all the areas. It'll be distributed a little bit differently than what we've seen historically.
So some of the areas of the community that have had some decline or disinvestment over time can have some new investment, some revitalization. And in doing this, we still address the needs for fringe area growth, lower density, single-family detached housing, but also some other lifestyle and housing options that the community wants and needs in response to changing demographics in the community, too. So providing a wider variety. I think we're going to have to stop with this map so we have enough time to talk to the council about some next steps and review process that you might want to see.
So another thing that seems to come up in the question is, given the emphasis on transit in the plan, people begin to wonder whether, you know, that's going to be the primary way for people to get around the city. That's by no means going to be the primary way that people get around the city. We're still going to have the vast majority of travel occurring in private vehicles. What you see on page 30 is the street network map. This is really based on the historic work that's been done by Volcog for both the city and county in terms of trying to develop a plan for the future. Street network, major street network in the city and in the surrounding area. So we largely continue that map, continue that plan forward in this plan. And really don't look at any significant changes in terms of a major street network. The other thing, just as kind of a reminder that we do with this street network plan, is you'll see, particularly in the edge areas, you'll see dotted lines kind of showing these are 1 square mile areas. That's, again, trying to emphasize the fact that in those areas, even if they develop all residentially, there still is a need for some amount of collector streets to go through those areas to disperse traffic reasonably in and out of those areas and from adjacent neighborhoods. So we want to make sure that that doesn't get lost because, you know, as we're dealing with development in the office, as development proposals come forward, that is a very typical issue. We'll see there is discussion with developers about the need for collector streets. So that's included, our residential collector streets. So that's included in the street network plan.
Okay. Mitzi, I think in the materials you provided, you were suggesting for consideration a fairly aggressive timetable here where public hearings could start yet this month and with ultimate final adoption as early as late December or perhaps mid-January. I just throw that out there just for the council to consider as far as your comfort level with that sort of a schedule or as Mitzi said, what you envision the next steps to be to further vet the information. Questions, comments?
I would say part of my comfort level with that is just the standpoint that a comprehensive plan should be an ongoing, evolving document. We can't let it sit like we've let it sit in the past. So bottom line, this is a big improvement over what we have today. So I, you know, like to bring it forward for discussion.
Other comments? I will say, I mean, it's there's a lot here. And even though we've been given the information over a period of time, there is a lot here. It incorporates a lot of new policy changes, some adoption of some change in thinking on how we approach transit or housing or parks or bicycles or whatever you want to put in there. So it does need to be appropriately discussed. Mr. Ruska.
I like what we see here today. I think Councilmember Hickey brings up a good point about the priorities of different plans and which one should be the over-encompassing plan that we all go to first and then secondary plans and so on. We should have that kind of, I think, determined before we get into this so that we aren't saying, well, this plan says this and downtown plan says, you know, the DMC plan. You know, I mean, we have a variety of them right now. And at the point that he made earlier, that some of these have been around for a long time and yet we still refer to them. And so I think we need to, as a council, determine the level of what's the priority here, and we can still use those for reference, but which ones are the ones that we really go to for these decisions so we don't have conflicts when we get to those points.
We would actually have drafted language that suggests that anytime there's a conflict between this plan and others, that this one supersedes.
Okay.
Unless there's disagreement with it, we refer to it.
Well, that makes it clear. You know, I just think that over the years we've had so many different ones, and it's hard to know when to sunset those and make the ones that we have in front of us, you know, the document that we're using. And I think that if that clears that up, you know, we might still have some secondary concerns with some of those other ones, but at least that clears that up. I mean, I'd like
and
to see that part.
You know, and the key in that, from a policy standpoint, this should guide, and those are all, you know, the granular, getting into the implementation,
right,
that should implement your policy. So
sure,
as we go through the revise of those, because those also have to be revised on an ongoing basis, you can always point back
right
to this.
Yeah.
I have very much, you know, might from time to time see these other plans as having merit, but I completely support the policy that the comprehensive plan is the superseding document, that it needs to be that way.
Yeah.
It takes so many of the battles off of our plate.
Well, it seems like a lot of those other plans, downtown master plan, or you know, some of these have been considered in this, and so you know they've served a purpose and gotten us to this point. But I think it's time that this becomes what we're aiming at. So.
Mr. Hickey.
So first of all, I want to thank Mitzi and Charlie. It was excellent. This is the best information we've had to date. We're still kind of at the conceptual level, though. I still think if we're serious about this, and when it's, I think we're at not quite what, 300 and some pages right now published. So by the time this is done, it's going to be a 400 and some page effort. And if we're not willing to take the time to go through it and kind of look at it in detail, I mean, if we're really serious about this and we're thinking this is the most important thing we're going to do as a council, is you know, planning for the future of the city, I think we should take our time and go through it section by section. I mean, as much as we want it to be done right now and approved, it's been a long time coming, and now this is the first time that we've really gotten to see the details. I think we should consider it in pieces over time and do a real approval with real oversight.
You know, and I agree that, and that was my comment earlier, is that there's a lot here to wrap our mind around. And one of the things that I'm actually happy to see this evening on our agenda is perhaps going forward on changes to the land development manual, because I think there are some things that we would like to think are the low-hanging fruit, if you will, and hopefully we can do some things in parallel. There's some things we could make in the shorter term, even while we are perhaps discussing the broader picture. So it's a nice parallel. Mr. Bildebeck.
I like this. I would suggest that even though we want to take a look at things as we go along, I think getting out to the public, doing the public meetings are a good thing, and I think we should start that process. And I just, we've seen this, we've talked about it. I think the fact is I have no problem with taking time and going through it, but I do think we can need to continue this process moving.
And in May, we actually took most all of what you're seeing in this material, probably three times this, out to the public. And we had about 7 public engagement meetings for the community, for community leaders, and we invited a lot of people to those. The press helped us get the word out on those. So what we heard today in our discussion, much of that's been covered in public settings. The drafts were then posted, and we have several hundred people who get notifications of those things when they're posted and been invited to give us comments, and we've met with some other groups as well. I will tell you, there are some folks out there who are very eager to get this approved because they want to see us move forward with the vision, and they're interested in seeing how we can build more opportunities for flexibility and diversity in our market.
I think one way to test the waters is that you were suggesting that this could go to Planning and Zoning Commission for a public hearing as early as late this month. That might be a way to test the waters to see what sort of feedback and reaction we're going to get from a broader community or public base. And then that might alter our thinking in terms of how quickly we want to move forward.
I think that's a great idea. They had scheduled a special meeting
I mean, I might be oversimplifying, but if we have a parade of people at Planning and Zoning that absolutely love it, no questions, let's go, versus outright, you know, what were you thinking? We got to start over. I think we need to know where we kind of take the pulse of the community.
The other question I guess I have for the council is, do we want to schedule another time to go deeper into sections 1 and 2 and also to discuss section 3, or just to discuss 3? You want a half day, a workshop, a whole day? If we get feedback tonight, we can get something arranged as soon as possible.
Mr. Hickey?
Well, I mean, I'd like to go through it section by section. So 2 hours at a time, but I mean, it's going to take, you know, I don't know how many pages you cover at a time. You know, 50 pages in detail each time, or whatever it's going to take. I mean, if we're serious, we should take the time to do it.
Is it possible for council to identify, as you go through, points that you really want to discuss, so that when we come together, we can come prepared to discuss those pieces instead of paragraph by paragraph?
So again, I'm trying to understand the process. So I mean, if it's going to planning and zoning for, you know, public hearings, then we're going to go back and restart or relook from the beginning. I mean, if the process is, you know, proceeding on that timeline, then it doesn't sound like we're going to make any substantive changes. Then it's just, we're just approving what's already been essentially published. If we're talking about going back and taking a look at it section by section, then I think you don't go forward with the planning and zoning. So I just think, I'm just one vote, but I think collectively we have to decide if everybody's satisfied with it and it's just moving down the tracks, then that's the way it is.
I'm supportive of initiating the public process.
And I think part of it is, as detailed as the comprehensive plan is, it's still a plan in many respects. And I think part of what we see in the land development manual, that's where the rubber really hits the road in terms of how you execute on the plan. So that's why I'm willing to tolerate a certain level of ambiguity in the comprehensive plan. I don't know that we'll ever get to a point where it's so prescriptive that you know, that we'll feel absolutely comfortable. I think we have to tolerate a certain amount of gray, and we'll move forward. Mr. Atkins?
Just be aware that there are several provisions in the land development manual that require consistency with a comprehensive plan prior to approval, namely preliminary plats, general development plans, variances, incentive developments, and any change to the text of a zoning text, a change to the text of the zoning ordinance. And so when you change the comp plan, you're going far beyond the comp plan, and you're actually changing indirectly the criteria for some of those land use approvals.
Certainly, density, a number of factors. So.
Okay, so I think what I'm hearing is go ahead with the public hearing with the Planning Commission, collect feedback that we're getting, that people are submitting to us online and whatnot. I think between Planning Commission, or before Planning Commission, even we may have to compile the suggested edits to the drafts that were posted based on some feedback we've gotten today and from other stakeholders. And I think what we would do is present that to you with track changes in the documents so you see where those are, so you don't have to look for them. And we'll see how it goes with the Planning Commission end of November. I think what we will need to do is to have a discussion with the council very quickly after that to determine if we're going to proceed with the public hearing on December 18th with the councils.
Okay. Ms. Johnson, you've been quiet. What are your thoughts?
Well, comprehensive plan is not my wheelhouse. So while I respect the idea of sitting there and going through it page by page, I mean, I learned a lot today. I learned more about a comprehensive plan than I thought I would ever learn in my life. I don't know if, like, based on my experience, if that's where the transit line should be and things like that. That is the planning department's wheelhouse. You know, I'm comfortable sending it to planning and zoning.
Ruska.
I know I said earlier that we hired this consultant to draft a plan for us, and have we made any changes to the plan since they drafted it?
I'm glad you asked that. Yes, actually, almost a year ago, our contract work for the consultant teams ended, and we had a significant amount of staff time put into the customizing of this for this community specifically to make sure the language is reflective of who we are as a city of Rochester. They add nuanced information to it, to clean up maps and to edit maps and so forth. And in that vein, I'd like to thank Charlie Ryder and Sandy Gosley specifically for giving up many evenings and weekends to make deadlines, to prepare materials for public engagement, to prepare for today. They've really put in an extensive amount of overtime, to be honest.
And Mitzi, is this information available on the web that we talked about today?
It is not yet, okay. But we can get this. Yeah.
So for those of you here, we apologize for the technical difficulties. We'll make sure we post this up on the site so you can see exactly all the numbers and maps that were being referenced for the last 2 hours.
All right. Mr. Ruska?
I guess I'd just ask if staff would be willing to meet with the if a council member or two had questions on some of the, you know, old policies, some of the wording on some of this, if you'd be open to that. So maybe we could get some of that, kind of addressed that way.
Absolutely.
You know, instead of trying to have, you know, it seems like to try to go through a lot over with everyone over takes an enormous amount of time with scheduling and just everything else that goes on. So I guess that would help me to kind of address some of the things that I have concerns about.
And I think the challenge from a calendar standpoint, we're headed right into budget discussions, and that's going to be very consuming of the council and staff. So these are two big things to be considering toward the end of the calendar year.
Two council members have already asked to meet with us, and we'll reach out again and propose some times for others if you would like to do that.
Maybe as a result of those discussions, I might suggest that someone scribe the information and then it could be shared so that we know, you know, what was some of the discussion, the highlights of the discussion, and maybe some alterations or edits that might have been made, just to keep everyone in the loop.
Track changes.
So I guess the question that would be then, if we do come up with some agreed upon changes and the hearings are already set, is that okay to do? You know, I mean, would we have to have another hearing on the changes, or how would we do that? That's the only thing that I can see in logistics.
If we have identified edits before we go to Planning Commission, which I think we already have some based on some of the input we have had, we will do track changes, and that will be presented to Planning Commission as part of the packet materials, so we'll have to have that in advance. The council wishes to have additional changes made before you act on it, we can fit that into the schedule.
Yeah, it can get problematic. I know we've been down that road before where you start to make edits to the edits and then no one knows what we're really finally adopting. It's going to take some good solid management of the process. All right, anything else for this afternoon, Mr. Wojcik?
I fear I'm going to get a call here, but we had a request from council member Campion to move the discussion on the arena to a future meeting. It was my intent to honor that request, and I was going to communicate with that with him, but is that the will of the council?
It's on the table. So
it's on the table.
Yeah.
Somebody would have to make a motion to remove
it.
Just knowing Mr. Campion, if we don't tell him it's not up, he might just show up. So.
No, I talked to him, and I told him that I would support that.
Yep, we'll all start.
Mr. Hickey.
I had a question. I've been seeing this the flag project we've seen kind of in the Post Bulletin over time. Saw it as just kind of an unofficial effort. You know, they've named themselves the Rochester Flag Committee, and when you look on their website, it looks kind of official, and they've got kind of an official timeline culminating with some kind of presentation to the city council, and which I just viewed it as just an organic effort. Now I walk into the rotunda and see we've got kind of a big advertisement for it, and entry forms, which makes it look kind of like we're endorsing this. So, I mean, I don't want it to get it to be like the Mayo Civic Center rename up to the final meeting, and all of a sudden it's a surprise. I mean, I certainly have no intention of redesigning the city flag. I don't know if there's a big push from within the city council if this seems like a priority. I mean, I just, in fairness to the artists, I assume people are taking time to submit entries if they are thinking this is an official effort of the city.
I thought we talked here about letting we had that group here to go ahead and we would look at it. So to my understanding, the mayor was working with them. Maybe I misunderstood, but I thought the mayor was working with them to do that. And the council had said, go for it. Go forward, enjoy, do your art, your flag, and bring it back to us.
So I'll ask the question. Is there any interest in redesigning the flag? I've got no interest.
I'd be happy to consider a better flag.
If that's something that they wish to do, I'm willing to look at it.
I mean, our flag is openly mocked by the media, as you know, we've won a couple of these worst flag competitions. So I have no issue changing it. I see nothing of value in maintaining the existing. So, but I don't see it as a high priority item either.
This has been pretty much a grassroots effort. There's no city resources or dollars going into this at this point. I think ultimately they will present a design to the city council, and then it's for us to take any action if we wish to replace the flag or not. But I encourage that sort of community effort, and I see no harm in it at this point.
Right.
Mr. Ruskin?
Just before we go, I meant to mention earlier, but you know, this what we saw today takes a lot of work and a lot of pulling things together. So, Charlie and Mitzi and Sandy, thanks for all your work on this. It was really well done today, and there's a lot of stuff here to be thrown at us, so I didn't want it to go unrecognized. And I think you had something to do with it, too.
Thank you. There's a big team behind this, and
we
all did a lot of great work.
Yeah. Ms. Johnson.
We discussed this before. I'm going to bring it up again. Consistent start times. I know we moved it to 3 o'clock for a while and moved it back to 3:30. Just 3:30 one week for 3 weeks in a row, and then 3 o'clock for 1 week, and then 3:30 for four more weeks is a little frustrating. It's hard to schedule around. It's difficult for the public to get there, too, especially with the 4-day notice for some people. So I'm just going to reemphasize consistent start times for the committee of the whole meeting.
I think the intent is 3:30. Today was unusual.
Well, we had a 3 o'clock a few weeks ago, a couple months ago, and then we, canceled the next one. And then, you know, so if we can, even if we split stuff up so that it kind of falls into a consistent time.
I would suggest we go to 3:30 meetings, and if on non-council evening nights, we can stay later if we have to on this kind of stuff. So put that on the second and fourth Mondays.
Yeah.
That way we're consistent on when we start, because I agree with work stuff.
Ditto. And this is, I have some things that are not time sensitive, but one thing that I am interested in is that any changes that need to be made in terms of staff recommendations to the massage therapy licensing ordinance over and above what we discussed. I think there's some ongoing discussion, and I'd like to make sure that before we have some of these other ones back in front of us, that we have recommendations from the police department, from the city clerk, anyone else that would be interested in weighing in on that, because you know, a couple of these we kind of rejected based on, you know, some very technical reasons, and if those technical reasons are resolved, we might have a little bit more of a difficult discussion on some of these. So
all right, anything else? All right, see everyone
let me get Mark for just a second.
Thank you.
Wow, you guys are fast.
Efficient.
Wow.
Did you just push this?
I got some right over there.
I don't know how to shut that off.